Welcome back. This is a long-anticipated program. I've had a lot of email asking me to please get Lawrence Gardner on the program. He is a very busy man. The time is right now. He is here. Actually, he is there in the U.K., and there in the U.K. is about 4 a.m. Are you there, Lawrence?
Hello there. Yes, I'm here, Jeff.
All right. The big question, did you stay awake or did you set the alarm and get up?
No, I'm still here from yesterday.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's been a strange few days. In fact, I'm just back from the States last night, sort of, I don't know, 20-odd hours ago, and I grabbed a few quick hours and started today, and I'm trying to catch up with the backlog now.
You're a little bit on U.S. time then still.
Yeah, I'm still in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, you sound great. So.
Yeah, I feel not so good.
Now, let's tell the people why you're here. The new book, and this truly is a page-turner. This is a great book. One of the most fascinating, intriguing journeys you can hope to go on now. The book is entitled, as many of you already know, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Yes, we're talking about that ark. Now, let me just read a little bit from the inside of the flyleaf. This is really nicely written. The Sacred Ark of the Covenant, created from a legendary substance, and much more about that substance in a few moments, is the source of one of the deepest mysteries of the Western world. No reason is given in the Bible as to why the Ark of the Covenant was so richly contrived, and no explanation exists of its awesome and deadly powers. What was the Ark of the Covenant? Where is it today? By accessing and assessing Rosicrucian archives in liaison with eminent nuclear physicist, Lawrence Gardner reveals how this lost secret of the distant past has led to the phenomenal new science of space-time manipulation. Is that a leap? Not. It's an amazing book, this whole story. He goes on to talk about the Egyptian Book of the Dead. There are so many things in this book. It's, again, one of those books that you can just about pick up and open to any page and be instantly intrigued. And I guess there's another way to talk about Lawrence Gardner. There are researchers, and then there is Lawrence Gardner. You really spend the time, years and years of your life, looking into these things. How tough is it to find new material, Lawrence? There are people who research this all the time, and yet there are people like you who seem to be able to come up with new material. How do you do it?
Well, it's a tenacious job, but it's not as difficult as one might imagine. It's really a question of knowing in the first place what you're looking for and then trying to find out where it is. What I discovered a long time ago was that so many books came out year after year after year on this or that subject, whatever it was, and they basically were, you know, an update on the books that had all been written before, and I just learned all back in the early 90s to forget most of the recent stuff and to go back to the first book in their bibliographies and see what the source material was for that. And all so often I found that once I got back to the way that it all began, it was very easy to discover that even perhaps the first person that wrote the first book had misinterpreted something or got something wrong, and everybody else had copied it for decades. So it was really a question of going back to source material, getting to know the people in the various libraries and museums and galleries around the world, and just building up a sort of liaison with them. And now I've just become, you know, fairly well known as a researcher. So when I'm on and I tell them that they've got something, even if it's not catalogued, they're pretty sure that they must have it somewhere.
Fascinating. What a relationship you have built up. There's that old saw about if you steal the work of one person, it's plagiarism. If you steal the work of a dozen people, it's research. And I think your point is very well taken. How many books have been written predicated on the first book of that genre, whatever, which could have been wrong and had key portions that were misstated. And from then, the misinformation just grows exponentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly based on history. I begin by being a historian, in fact, an art historian, essentially, in the very first place. And, you know, the one thing that I learned about history way back was that it was generally not taught as it was originally written. So we grow up with these sort of misconceptions of things, and we learn from our schoolrooms and pulpits and whatever, but what we're learning is a sort of contrived version of something that suits the, you know, the moment, and it's not necessarily what the person there at the time wrote down.
Not at all, and we merely have to look back to World War II as a prime case in point. The winners write the story. Losers are written out of the act completely.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always two sides. I can remember back in the 50s, I was sort of 12 years old. I was at school. It wasn't that long after the war, and they did what was probably the first student exchange program with France, and I went over there, and I was sat in the class listening to a lesson about the Battle of Agincourt in the 1400s, and I thought, well, that's amazing, because we learned about that last term, and it wasn't the same battle at all. and of course, there's an English side and a French side, and
that's right.
Really, I took it from there, and it's been with me ever since.
Biggest challenge, perhaps, for an historian like yourself is to wade back through the mists of time and to try to get a sense for what may have really happened.
Mm. Yeah.
Not easy.
It's not. I mean, sometimes, I guess once one gets a handle on the process, you can almost be intuitive about it, and to get a feeling about something that doesn't feel right. You know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I write has been, in the past, maybe considered sort of contentious. It's now becoming coarse reading over here in the school,
uh-huh,
so it's
uh-huh.
not a big thing now. But, you know, what happens is that I find that if I'm speaking at lectures or whatever, and I make some announcement or statement that might have seemed preposterous 20 years ago, people sort of sit there and they think, yeah, that feels a bit more comfortable than what I was told, you know? And it might be strange stuff, but it sits more comfortably because it's more grounded. And, you know, I think a lot of what we've been taught is put together because of vested interest, and it's understandable. You know, politics rule the education, church rules the education. And so, you know, what we're taught is that is not necessarily what was there. And I can remember one occasion where a Dominican friar, we were on TV, and this guy was there with his habits and chains on, and I thought that this is like the Inquisition, you know. But it
or
was,
Halloween, whichever.
Yeah, I mean, he actually said that he thought I was one of the greatest upholders of the Bible text that he'd ever come across. And although it may seem that I challenged church dogma, what I have proved time after time is that that's only because they're teaching of the Bible text isn't actually generally what the Bible says. If you read what it says, it's quite different in most cases.
Hmm. How much of the Bible is intact after the great rewrite, I guess the Council of Nicaea is pointed to by a lot of scholars and dilettantes as well, as being a great revision of the Bible? How much of that is true, Lawrence, and how much of the Bible, in your estimation, is really what it once was? Or is it an evolving work? I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but
it does evolve, but generally the evolvements of recent times, and there have been many, many editions over the last 100 years, I suppose, but they're all basically rewrites of some form of standard edition, normally the King James edition of the Bible, which is still the sort of standard, and it's actually fairly close to the text. Is not a bad translation at all, as far as I can see. The problem is that we don't have the originals. You know, the Old Testament in its true original form doesn't really exist now. The Hebrew Old Testament actually comes from the 900s. The New Testament, as we have it, comes from the 300. So it's a bit of a weird situation because the Old Testament that we have is newer than the New Testament.
It is, yes.
But we do have the text of the old Greek Septuagint, which was put together a little bit 300 BC, that sort of thing. And it's been messed around with a bit over the years. But if you look at that and compare it with the King James Bible, they're not too far adrift. So, you know, one runs with the best material one has. And My feeling is if we're looking at English translations, then we're still not going to beat the 1611 version.
True enough. The book has some exquisite illustrated plates in it. I want to tell you, there aren't dozens and dozens of them, but what there are, they're stunning. Was it difficult to pick out the ones you wanted?
Not really. It was actually difficult to edit back to the ones I used. Because I only had 16 pages to play with, and no, throughout the period of putting this book together, and remember this book is one of a series, so I'd been amassing this information for a good while before. I had lots of images and pictures I could have used. I mean, what I really try and do is to use them in a way to kind of try and demonstrate the text. I endeavor to make them entertaining pictures and varied pictures if possible.
The baptism of Jesus.
That's a fascinating picture.
That is one of the most fascinating pictures that I have ever seen. I've seen it before, of course. It's stunning.
For those
of you who aren't familiar with it, it's an example of Renaissance art showing it's a huge flying disc above the baby Jesus with four lights coming down on him.
Yeah, it's quite astonishing. I mean, there are numerous pictures like that from that era, and in fact from earlier and even slightly later times. But I picked that one really because I'm familiar with it. It hangs here in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, it's a picture that I've known for a long time.
I thought you were going to stay in your living room for a moment there.
I wish.
Yes, indeed. All right. Stand by. We'll come right back with Lawrence Gardner as we talk tonight about his new book, A Stunner, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Okay, we're back. I'm glad you're there. Lawrence Gardner is my guest these 2 hours tonight. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Lots to talk about. With all the interest, Lawrence, and you forgive me if I go here just for a minute or two, because I want to draw people into your book as best I can. And certainly the Harry Potter films and books have made a name that otherwise would have languished in obscurity, rather famous, if not infamous, and that, of course, Nicholas Flamel. I saw a story recently of some people in France, I'm not sure of the city, who actually owned the house that Nicholas Flamel used to own and I believe was born in or lived in, and they're running some kind of a small restaurant in it now. I don't know if you knew that or not.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's true. Tell us, what is Nicholas Flamel to all this?
Well, Nicholas Flamel was a French chemist back in the 15th century. He was not unlike many people of his type at the time. He was fairly quiet, fairly reclusive, got on with his work, and he ended up being what I suppose most people refer to him to now as an alchemist, involved with working with gold and the Philosopher's Stone. But it happened by chance. He came across a book, apparently, this is how the story goes, an ancient book, copper-bound book, full of wonderful recipes and information written by an old Jewish fellow, and he bought it very cheaply for a couple of florins or something like that, I believe, and he became so immersed in this that he spent 20 years studying it over and over and over again, then began apparently to put his text into practice in his lab, and lo and behold, it doesn't say too much then in the story about what happened, although there's lots of writings from him and his records, but he subsequently became enormously rich, very, very rich. He founded schools and hospitals and put money into all sorts of institutions and became a legend within his own lifetime, unusually, and it seems that this was done by his understanding and use of the Philosopher's Stone, and that's really, I suppose, a kind of center point of my book in terms of what is it, what was it. And the interesting thing is that in his last testament in November 1416, he actually gave us a few clues, but the biggest clue was that he sort of set the record straight and said, look, the Philosopher's Stone is not about making gold as such. One can use it for transformation purposes, but the stone is itself made from gold. It's gold, he said, of the very purest kind, digested to its highest degree of subtle fixation. It's called a stone, he said, because it resists fire like stone, but its appearance is that of a very fine powder. And that's fascinating because it actually ties up with other writings of other alchemists of later times. In Britain, we have the Royal Society, founded by Charles II in the 1600s, and in 1667, another of the great members of that scientific fraternity, which is still our frontline scientific organization today, wrote a similar treatise. He had it published in Amsterdam, and he said exactly the same thing, you know, despite what people might think. The Philosopher's Stone is not a stone as such, it's a powder, and it's made from gold.
The substance.
Yeah.
Now, we have always on this planet had a fixation, a fascination, an obsession with gold. Most people would suggest that it's because of its color and its rarity and all the rest of it. But in your research and the work of others, it turns out that gold has far more going for it than just beauty and scarcity. Far more.
Yeah, gold's an enigmatic substance, really. I mean, it's quite enchanting because of its warmth and its color and its density and all that sort of thing. But, you know, it struck me as odd when I embarked on this, actually, the way that we use gold today. If one looks back into ancient times, Egypt or even Russia in the 1600s and whatever, one sees gold, what seems to be in abundance. Doorsteps are made of it, roofs are made of it, everything's covered in it. It's everywhere. And yet, when I spoke to the World Gold Council, they said, well, amazingly, out of all of the gold that has ever been mined, 90% of it has been mined since 1843. So all of that great abundance was just 10% of the gold that has been mined to date. And I looked into it a little further, and I thought, well, it's really odd. What do we do with the gold? Well, we've been using it for ages now to underpin national currencies.
Mm-hmm.
So we dig the gold up from the earth, and we melt it down, and we turn it into blocks, and we bury it back under the earth again.
Which is a
strange process, because if one's using a valuable substance to underpin currency, you know, there's plenty of things that are rarer, scarcer, more valuable, but less weighty and less cumbersome than gold. It takes a lot of space. It's difficult to move around. And so it rather appeared that actually there was something inherent maybe in our psyche that was telling us that gold was of enormous value, not maybe just for its monetary weight, but for some particular use. And lo and behold, as the new science that I've written about in the book sort of came to the fore in the middle 1990s, all of a sudden, 4 years ago, we start the national gold auctions, and suddenly all of these valuable currency reserves are being sold.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly, the IMF gave approval to 22 countries. Britain now is more than 50% light on the gold that it had 3 years ago. It's
right.
All been sold off, and the British Treasury won't announce who's bought the gold. What I found rather stunning was that, your little commercial advert just now talked about the way that gold price rises, and it certainly does. It goes on going up and up and up. But oddly enough, just before the auctions, quarterly, on each of the days before, the gold price drops. Whoever buys it very cheaply, and the next day it's back booming again at the high price. So it looked as if, to me, as if there was something being organized here, as if gold was being moved into particular hands for a particular reason.
Indeed. Now let's pursue that in just a couple minutes. We take a break. Lawrence Gardner is my guest. He, of course, the author of the international bestseller, Bloodline of the Holy Grail. We'll be right back. Researcher Lawrence Gardner, glad you're along tonight. His book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, is a terrific contribution to our awareness and knowledge of things that go back to our very roots, I guess, in recorded history. Talking a bit about gold, of course, has been and continues to be manipulated on the international market for quite some time. And you've got some ideas on why, Lawrence. Tell me more.
Well, It seems now, I mean, it's difficult to know why for quite a long time. Gold's a very secure investment, there's no doubt of that.
And it will never crash.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to invest particularly in gold in recessionary times or depressionary times or whatever. It's fairly stable, and if it does take a dive here and there, it's not for long, it comes back. So it's very consistent. It's in recent times, really, just the last few years with the gold reserves being sold off. That's really bothersome. This isn't normal gold trading. This is selling off those
exactly.
things that actually underpin our economic systems.
It's almost like committing economic suicide in a way.
Yeah.
You're throwing away your foundations. It's bizarre. I agree with
yeah.
you.
I mean, here we're calling it swapping. That's the official term, and they don't call it selling. They call it swapping.
Mm-hmm.
What we're swapping it for is euros. And that's rather odd if you think about it. If you look at the way that money fluctuates, sterling itself is a much, much more reliable currency than the euro. It's a little bit doubtful,
absolutely,
the euro.
Of
so
course.
What we're actually in a situation where we're now underpinning sterling with euros instead of gold.
Well,
which makes
so what's
no
the sense? I mean, no, it doesn't make any logic. There's none there.
That's right.
I don't have the answers, but something's up.
Yeah. I mean, so something's happening. It's not just with gold. It's happening in the platinum markets as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are numerous platinum group metals that are involved. We've got platinum, palladium, iridium, ruthenium, rhodium, and osmium. They're the main metals.
And don't forget gardnerium.
Yeah. But, I mean, these are mined essentially the biggest seams in South Africa. And up until, you know, a couple of three years ago, you know, there were a number of companies in Britain or in America and various places in the West that were interested in platinum mines. But there were also a lot of African-owned mines, you know. They called them the black-owned mines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened a few years ago was that five of these British and American companies linked up together. They formed the Anglo-American Platinum Corporation. And they set to really trying to buy up all the African-owned mines that they could. So suddenly, not only an interest in gold, but an interest in platinums. And it really came to my attention in October, 1st of October in the year 2000, when there was a full page or two page article in one of our biggest national newspapers, the Daily Telegraph. And in fact, it followed on from something which I'd predicted in one of my earlier books, Genesis of the Grail Kings, because I'd introduced this subject and I'd said, look, it won't be long before suddenly there are big interest in platinums and they'll be looking at the fuel cell market
mm-hmm.
as an alternative to fossil fuels and oil. And in fact, that's exactly what this article was about. Everybody in Britain and America who's controlling anything is now interested in platinums for that reason. And they interviewed the chief executive of AMPLATS, Anglo-American Platinum Corporation, and he said, look, you know, the big surge in this market now is not going to be jewelry or anything like that. It's going to come from the fuel cell market. And then they interviewed the chairman of Johnson Matthey, the precious metal dealers, and he said, yep, everybody's in on it now. All the leading motor manufacturers, aircraft manufacturers, were all looking at platinum group metals and for fuel cells. So this really tied in with what I'd predicted, and it's not as straightforward as that. One doesn't just take a piece of metal, you know, and use it for a fuel cell. One actually needs an energy storage device, something which can pull in energy, store energy, and give away energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it really all led me back to a subject which I've been studying for since 1994, 95, I think, and that was the history of what had become to be called monatomic elements. And these are single or double atom elements, monatomic or diatomic elements, made from gold or platinum. And these are quite extraordinary. Given that these are single element metals, they can actually, their microclusters can be broken down and the metal-metal bonding can be broken, so that they simply fall apart into an amazing white powder substance. Now, this white powder substance is what becomes superconductive. If highly charged and energized, there's a certain process which will do that, but it will actually become, it stores energy by way of light waves. So it becomes quite remarkable. It becomes anti-gravitational. I mean, it becomes all the things that the world of aircraft and space technology and even the medical industry have been looking for.
Sure.
Yeah. And so the picture gradually began to pull together and one could see what was happening, really, in as much as that the scene was changing in terms of fuel. We've got about 30 years worth of oil left, I suppose, if we're careful with it. It will need the West to take a reasonable amount of control over the oil fields in the Middle East, and we've seen an example of that beginning to happen now with the Iraq situation. But we're actually moving into an area where there's going to be a new technology, and we will move from fossil fuels into this new superconductive science.
Yeah, and not a moment too soon either.
No.
Lawrence Gardner is so cool when he was talking about palladium and platinum, and I threw out there gardnerium. He just pretended like he didn't hear it. There's a little humor there.
Well, it's not actually on the list of those that they're using.
From over here on the other side, yes.
Gardnerium has not been released yet, you see.
But you see, I'm organizing investors now. We're going to get in on this early, Lawrence. All right, be right back in just a couple minutes. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Gold, a powdered form of gold. You heard him say some amazing things about that, and we'll pursue that and much more in just a couple minutes. Superconductive monatomic gold. Superconductive monatomic gold. Some of the things that you just mentioned, Lawrence Gardner, are science fiction, of course, but in point of fact, they are apparently reality. And the big question immediately, which your book deals with in large measure, is how long ago did our ancients, or even ancients before them, know about these kinds of things?
Well, it seems a remarkably long time ago. The picture comes together quite slowly, although in the book it reads as if it's a quick process. But my intuition fed me back to the ancient texts. In fact, you know, once the research got going in the middle 1990s, the research was going before then, but that's when it began to become public. And it revolved around an accidental discovery there, in fact, by a cotton farmer called David Hudson in Arizona, in Tempe, Arizona. And he had discovered some constituents in his soil that didn't seem to make a lot of sense. You know, they wouldn't be impregnated by water. They made the crop farming very difficult. So he decided to test them. And the first thing that happened was that he discovered that when he sort of set them aside, having sort of sieved them out and just sort of put them on the side of the field, under the sun, they just blaze into a great flash of light and completely disappear, as if it was never there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, the research began, and in fact, with spectroscopic analysis and gravimetric analysis and that sort of thing, it was discovered that this material transformed into this white substance, which suddenly became very miraculous. It was a powder. It was white, and it began to show some remarkable properties. In as much as when one heated it and cooled it, its weight started to fluctuate amazingly. And
not supposed to happen.
No, I mean every time they cooled it, it got heavier. And they actually got it down to about 500 times its original weight, and then on heating it, it would go to way below zero. In fact, there was a point at which it started to levitate, and then there was a point at which it would simply just disappear in this blaze of light.
David Hudson, if I might interject one thing here, I was online when David Hudson began making noise about this. I'm sure you were aware of it at the time, too. I guess this would have had to be about 94 or 95.
That's when he started coming public, yeah.
Yeah. And okay. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I was going to say it was then that he sort of lodged his patents and really was having to do talks around the country there to just get it into the open so that it would sort of tie it to him at that time.
Exactly. He was trying to sell various things and so forth. It was quite, it was an internet scene. It was.
Yeah. But it came and it sort of went. I mean, he was sort of forced out of business in the end, really, by, I don't know. I mean, there's all sorts of variations on the theme, but the government departments didn't like him too much. But what struck me about it was that this weight, you know, and the fact that it turned out to be precious metal elements and whatever. And it occurred to me, I thought that's really interesting because looking back at the old documentation about the Philosopher's Stone, there's a particular Alexandrian text that comes from about 320 BC. And it talks about there that something they called the Paradise Stone, which is said was a magical powder of projection. And within the text, it actually says that it has the amazing quality of outweighing its own quality of gold. However, when it transforms to a powder, even a feather will tip the scales against it. So it was exactly the same scenario. You know, this thing was heavier than gold, or it was lighter than a feather.
300 BC.
That was 300 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what actually happened was that I then started to look at the old texts, and I began with the Bible, as I generally do. That leads me to other things, and you know, the first thing I found in the Bible was talk of this white powder in a very strange sort of way, and it turns up in the story of Moses and the Israelites at Mount Horeb in Sinai, and Moses gets angry with his brother for collecting up all the golden trinkets from the Israelites, and he melts them down and makes a golden calf as an idol of worship, and this makes Moses sort of angry. So then the story becomes rather strange. It says that Moses confiscated the golden calf, he burnt it with fire, transformed it into a powder, and mixed it with water and fed it to the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
So there we have this powder being sort of used as a type of food. The story then goes on to explain a little further on. We're talking about this white powder, which incidentally is a bad translation in the King James Bible because it calls it a white flour, but originally it translates as powder.
Oh,
same thing again.
Okay.
And it talks about how one wipes this with frankincense and makes it into bread cakes. And these bread cakes are there for the priests and certain people. And later on in the book, we find that King David, when he tried to get some of this bread, the high priest wouldn't allow him to, and he says, you're not, you know, ready for it yet. So it's pretty special stuff. Then one looks at the Egyptian text and begins to find it there. All sorts of pictures and graphs, graphics around the place showing presentations of conical objects, sort of held in the hands of priests and being offered to the kings or offered to the gods. And it doesn't really explain too much about them, although there is an example of where it tells us a lot about them. But interestingly, if we go to the Temple of Karnak, there's a relief there. It's about the treasures of Pharaoh Tutmosis III, and it shows all the treasures of the king at that time, and it's got them in various sections, the gemstones and the metals and this sort of thing. And then mm-hmm. there are these little conical objects just sort of sitting there on a shelf,
mm-hmm.
and it says that mm-hmm. These are made of gold, but we call them white bread. And so interesting again, the bread and the gold seems to come together. One is seeing here that this material was used then for ingesting. And further examination of the text actually shows that it had a name. They called it Mufkut, M-F-K-Z-T it translates to, and I've thrown in a couple of U's just to make it able to say it, but M-F-K-Z-T, mm-hmm. Mufkut. And
well, people were eating this. What was it supposed to do, Lawrence? Their consciousness to a higher spiritual level?
It seems to have some quite extraordinary powers.
Mm-hmm.
The stories were... I mean, it goes back into Babylonia as well, into Iraq, before Egypt. You know, one finds it there. It's called Shemana, Highwood Firestone.
Same thing.
What they call it. Same thing, exactly. And this was being fed to the early kings by the priests.
Have you tried any yourself?
Yes. I mean, it's a coarse thing, really. It's a ritualistic, ongoing, lifelong thing. It seems to sort of build it up within one's body. But, I mean, I've been sort of doing tests with labs and evaluating stuff for various people who are making versions of it. So, yeah, I mean, I've tried it just to see if it tastes right, because I now know what it should analyze at, what it should taste like, that sort of thing. But it was supposed to heighten various powers.
Vibrational?
They were sort of breeding a race of kings and guardians and governors, the people that were going to control and rule the lands and whatever. So it was figured that these people needed to be more like gods than people. They needed to be in a thoroughly enlightened, heightened state. And so this ritualistic course of this substance, which they called the powder of projection and all sorts of things, was meant to heighten their powers of perception and awareness and intuition, you know, all those qualities of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, tests recently have actually proved that this seems to be the case. What happens, and it almost depends on which of the metals you're using in this particular state. They have different effects, but...
Can they all be basically reduced to this monatomic state?
Yeah, they can all be. All of these single element metals, yeah.
Is
it's
it
what
hard?
They call the transition group.
Okay, is it hard to do?
There are numerous ways of doing it, actually. I mean, it can be done chemically. It can be done with electricity, electronic arcing. There is a sodium burn process, which is probably what they used in very ancient times. But yeah, no, it's not that easy. It's really a question of sort of shocking the material, you know, confusing it so that it forgets what it is, and the atoms get in a mess and the electrons start spinning the wrong way around the nuclei and it just falls apart. It just can't remain metal anymore. But the funny thing is, the moment that happens, when one then analyzes it, what was a piece of gold 2 minutes before now tests as various other elements. It tests as silica and aluminum and calcium and oxygen and all sorts of things.
Alchemy.
Everything
are
precious metals.
There's
yeah.
alchemy.
And so what actually happens is that one can transform that back into a metal, and there you have effectively a sort of philosopher's stone scenario. You're taking a substance which isn't gold and turning it into gold, effectively. And anyway, what science seems now to prove is that what happens is that the ingestion of these substances actually has an effect on the endocrinal glandular system. And so what it does, it sort of sparks and energizes hormonal secretions. And, I mean, for example, it rather seems that monatomic gold or diatomic gold seems to have its main effect on the pineal gland. So it enhances melatonin production. Iridium seems to have more effect on the pituitary gland, so it enhances serotonin production. So you can see that one can either use these independently to do a particular job, or you could sort of take them together as a sort of mixture, which would be a sort of multivitamin thing, you know, and it would do a little bit of everything. And
a little pricey, but fascinating.
So, yeah, I mean, it's pricey if one considers it in that state, but the interesting thing was, as David Hudson proves, and it's now been proved all over the world, this stuff is actually available and can be found in a natural circumstance. One doesn't have to have the gold or the platinum in the first place to make
right.
it, and this is becoming intriguing. I mean,
well,
this is, you know, really what causes a problem for governments, because, you know, if the future of medicine and fuel rests in something which
yes.
can just be obtained from seabed sediments and things like that,
uh-huh.
Then, you know, where goes the revenues? Where goes the tax monies? Where goes all the profits
where
that actually underpin the world economy? Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
the world economy collapses. So you can understand why they weren't sort of too happy about this.
So what we're saying,
put the lid on it.
As we go to our break, what you're saying here is the ancients knew how to take gold and turn it into other elements and then turn it back
they
into
did.
Gold. And... The next step is they probably knew how to take other elements and turn them into gold.
Yeah.
So yeah, there we go.
Exactly.
That's sums up a fascinating hour with Lawrence Gardner already. We'll do another hour in just a few minutes. All of this is essayed brilliantly in his new book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. You just heard some remarkable information, so think about that in terms of... what's going on in the World Economic Forum? Dollars, paper, gold, precious metals. One wonders if people are making gold as we speak. Could be. We'll be back. Again, I want to point out the book has some marvelous illustrations in it. It's just an extraordinary book. And we'll continue our conversation right after this.
Hi, I'm Brant Tarkenton. If you have a personal or small business legal problem and need an attorney, do you know where to turn? Well, you could pick up the phone and call an attorney in your area. But who do you call and what will it cost? Prepaid Legal, a New York Stock Exchange company, is the leader in providing affordable legal services. 52% of adults will have a legal issue this year. Every family, every small business needs Prepaid Legal. So grab a pen. We're going to give you a toll-free number at the end of this message so you can have access to top-rated lawyers for the price of a cup of coffee a day. For one low monthly fee, you'll have unlimited access to a top-quality law firm in your state. Also, our plan covers real estate transactions, wills and trusts, divorce, bankruptcy, traffic tickets, personal injury, workman's comp, criminal matters, employment issues, and business disputes, and much, much more.
Get a free will with enrollment. Call Prepaid Legal today at 1-800-452-1630. That's 1-800-452-1630.
Patented Trim Spa is an announcer's dream. It's so great talking about a product where the folks who use it say what the radio commercial says. Here's Sheila Gilmore, one of the young lovelies who competed in the Trim Spa American Dream Contest in the Bahamas.
My agent actually recommended Trim Spa. Trim Spa actually did a lot for me. First of all, Trim Spa is a great energy booster. I like taking it. First thing in the morning, gets me going. What I mostly found is that it is an excellent appetite suppressant. I haven't been in this good of shape since I was probably in grade school. I feel healthier. I have more energy. I could go on and on.
Well, maybe you'll settle for the shape that you had at 25. Whatever. Patented Trim Spa burns fat fast. It lets you feel full faster, sparks energy as the pounds melt away, and helps you get your dream body faster than you ever thought possible. Get an amazing 110% guarantee when you order at TrimSpa.com or call 1-800-TRIM-SPA. That's TrimSpa.com or 1-800-TRIM-SPA. Call today. Start losing weight right away.
USA Radio Network News, I'm Jason Walker. The Senate has just approved a $350 billion tax cut plan that votes 51-49. United States has indicted two Yemeni men in the USS Cole bombing that killed 17 sailors.
From the very first moments of the Cole tragedy, the FBI has been committed to bringing to justice those who were behind this attack. The FBI deployed nearly 200 agents and support personnel to Yemen for the arduous work of finding who was responsible.
FBI Director Robert Mueller and Attorney General John Ashcroft says the Cole bombing was simply murder.
On October the 12th in the year 2000, terrorists piloted a small boat laden with high explosives alongside the USS Cole. They did so with the intent to ambush and kill as many Americans as possible.
Researchers now say secondhand smoke may not be as harmful as previously believed. The report in the British Medical Journal finds exposure to secondhand smoke is not associated with deaths from heart disease or lung cancer. However, other scientists disagree, claiming the research is flawed and simply not adequate to measure the impact of passive smoke. This is USA Radio News.
If you're losing your hair, then I have great news for you. Now you can have twice as much hair within 90 days, guaranteed. Announcing Hair Advantage, the world's most advanced hair regrowth system that will reverse baldness, fill in embarrassing bald spots, and regrow up to twice as much new hair, guaranteed. The secret of Hair Advantage lies in a recent medical discovery that showed 95% of all hair loss was due to the body's overproduction of DHT. Hair Advantage stops DHT from attacking your hair follicle as it starts regrowing new hair in balding areas. Hair Advantage contains a patented active ingredient that was approved by the FDA for hair regrowth. In clinical studies, the majority of people regrew their hair, with almost half experiencing dense hair regrowth. So call now for your risk-free trial, and you can have twice as much hair within 90 days, guaranteed. Hair Advantage is safe, clinically proven, and effective on virtually everyone. Call toll-free 1-800-862-1814. That's 1-800-862-1814. 1-800-862-1814.
Federal agents are investigating the Riyadh bombings. We have more on that story from USA's Connie Long.
A small FBI team is now in Saudi Arabia assisting Saudi authorities in the investigation of the bombings. This time they expect to receive greater cooperation from Saudi authorities who realize Saudi Arabia was hurt by the bombings. Some in the Saudi leadership and media have sharply criticized Islamic terrorists, extremist clerics, and terrorist forces who train outside the kingdom. But experts say a large percentage of Saudi society supports the extreme Wahhabi sect and sanctions the killing of Westerners. Connie Lawn, USA Radio News, Washington.
A Schenectady, New York man has been charged in Texas with the deaths of 18 people who were in the country apparently illegally. Matt is accused of abandoning the tractor-trailer rig in South Texas he drove in which the bodies were discovered. This is USA Radio News.
Gold Formula Beautiful Hair Breck Shampoo is back.
Growing up, I used Breck Shampoo. Who didn't? So when I saw the Gold Formula Breck in the classic bottle was back, of course I bought it. I felt the difference immediately after washing my hair. It felt like it did when I was 18, and I'm far from 18. And Breck still has that amazing, clean, fresh scent and that rich lather. My hair felt clean and looked great. Soft, shiny, and manageable. Breck is back. I loved it then. I love it now.
Rediscover Breck Shampoo and your hair.
Did you know that the air in your home can actually be many times more polluted than the outside air? It's true. Our homes are so airtight today, we often wind up recycling dirty air and suffering from all kinds of allergies and related illnesses as a result. Well, now you can put an end to the cycle of indoor air pollution by installing the Dust Doctor 100 electrostatic air filter in place of those throwaway types.
We've used the Dust Doctor 100 only 4 days, but we can already tell the difference in our breathing.
She's 100% healthier and happier.
The Dust Doctor 100 electrostatic air filter has brought relief to thousands of allergy sufferers during the last 10 years and is recommended by doctors everywhere for persons who suffer from airborne allergies.
It's wonderful. I can breathe better and my house smells fresher.
To order, have your credit card ready and call toll-free 1-866-PMI-ORDER. That's 1-866-PMI-ORDER.
Do you publish books, magazines, catalogs, calendars, cards, or posters? If so, you may be missing a valuable opportunity to separate your prepress work from your printing. For many years, major publishers have benefited from allowing prepress professionals to handle all of their scanning, proofing, film output, and direct-to-flight file preparation needs. They know that prepress professionals understand their jobs best and usually produce a better product faster and for less money than their printer. DMI USA has been providing high-quality prepress services for some of the largest publishers in this country for over 10 years. Learn what other publishers already know. DMI USA can be a valuable resource on any major printing project. If you want to compare prices and services on your prepress needs, give the folks at DMI USA a call. That's Digital Media Incorporated USA at 1-800-574-2350. 1-800-574-2350. Or visit them on the web at DMIUSA.com. That's DMIUSA.com.
Okay, I'm glad you're here. Let's start our second hour with Lawrence Gardner tonight. He, of course, the author of the international bestseller Bloodline of the Holy Grail, among other great books. His newest, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, is available now. Beautifully produced book, utterly intriguing from cover to cover. We've talked about some fascinating things in the first hour, much to come in this hour as well. Lawrence, there are a couple of pictures in here. Among the many that are more than intriguing to me, and I'm sure when you first came across them, you had that same feeling, if not more. One of them is a color plate, Mysterious Relief at the Temple of, well, it's a Dendera, or Dendera. Dendera?
How do you pronounce yes, it? I mean, just pronounced differently, Dendera.
All right. And then we go back to the black and white image of that same kind of device. It's a man holding something that appears to be emitting a ray or some kind of power energy source connected with a long cable. I first saw this in Christopher Dunn's marvelous book, The Giza Power Plant. How does this factor into the material we've discussed so far, this apparent advanced electronic or some kind of energetic device?
Well, at first glance, one would appear that it didn't have anything to do with it at all. And in fact, I never imagined that it would turn out to be in the book. It sort of got in there by kind of accident, because there was an intriguing connection potentially. The Dendera relief, for those who don't know what they are, they're quite amazing. There's a temple at Dendera, which is near Luxor in Egypt. It's a very old temple, although the above ground part of it was built in the first century. But the temple itself was much, much older, and it was the key temple of the goddess Hathor. The Egyptian goddess Hathor, who was the sort of goddess who produced the milk for the gods, apparently, for the kings, that sort of thing. Now, these reliefs are quite stunning. They go all around the crypt area in the old part of the temple, and they show what appear to be priestly-like figures holding these strange objects, and they're in pairs, you know, one priest facing another with these objects that appear to be many, many feet long, and they're sort of tubular devices that look like a cathode ray tube or something of that sort, like a big bulbous thing. And they've got serpents inside them, and they've created a lot of debate over the years, and there are many aspects to it. You know, there are certain people who think they were part of some fertility cult, and others have written that they thought that they were electronic devices, rather like light bulbs of some sort, although they're pretty enormous. And they're clearly not very heavy, just given the way that they're being held. And what actually happens is that they're in pairs, and the tip of each of these bulbous devices in each of the pairs is just about to touch the tip, or in fact, it's just touching the tip of the other guy's one on the other side. So they're just coming together, like holding two light bulbs, fat end to fat end. And I've been as intrigued by these as anybody else, and they really came up by, I mean, we can perhaps talk about this other temple of Hathor in a moment, but I was looking at Hathor temples, and I came upon these, and by that time I was talking to physicists and nuclear physicists and people about the subject in general, the white gold and the powders and whatever, and I said, you know, just by chance, you know, have you, as a nuclear physicist, to one of these doctors, I said, have you ever considered these things? You know, what do you think they are? And he said, yeah. He said, actually, I think that the mistake everybody's making here is that one is looking at the bubble as being a sort of container in a physical sense of some sort, like a glass tube or whatever. He said, but he said, I've got a feeling, he said, we discussed this at a recent physicist conference. He said, I've got a feeling that if we look at them rather like cartoons where speech bubbles come out of people's mouths, the bubble's there, one can see the outline of it, but the important thing is what's inside the words. He said, now, we're just wondering if perhaps these could be similar, whereby the sort of goings on inside this, that the sort of energy waves, that these sort of waves that the serpents are making are the important thing, and the exterior is just showing us the exterior of something. Now, he said, in essence, you know, if you're bringing two objects like that together, it's very much like we would do with sort of Meissner effect experiments in physics, and if you can actually create flux tubes, he said, and these are strange devices which actually seem to sort of open up portals into other dimensions. So you bring these two fields. They're like fields, really. That's how they were explained to me. And you bring the fields together, and you create a sort of a portal flux tube. And I thought that's really interesting. And he kept talking about fields all the time. And I went back to the Egyptian text again, and I thought I'd read this before somewhere. And I found it's in the pyramid text, actually, which is they're ancient sacred texts at the temple of the tomb of King Unas at Saqqara. They came from the 5th dynasty in Egypt. And they talk there about fields. And within the text, they specifically talk all the time about the field of Mufkuts. And we're back to the Mufkuts again, and this white powder and the gold and whatever. And the field of Mufkuts is the important realm. It's described as a realm where the kings live forever with the gods. And there are all sorts of rituals, and even the Book of the Dead, you know, gives away some of the rituals of the king sort of progressing and making his journey towards this sort of otherworldly existence. So it seems that the Mufkuts, the powder, comes together with the field. And there was this guy talking about these things being fields, and they were in the Temple of Hathor.
Wow.
I thought, well, that's brilliant, because that actually leads me right back to the other Temple of Hathor, which was almost where my quest in this began, and that's the Temple of Hathor in Sinai on the mountain where Moses was said to have been with the Israelites in the Bible when he did his thing with the golden calf.
Wow. What a loop.
Yeah, it's a real loop. How are we doing for time? Can I start this before the break?
Doing fine. We got about 4 minutes until
the break. Okay, well, the story is this. Back in the 1800s, middle 1800s, the word archaeologist sort of moved into our language. It hadn't been there before, and archaeologists became people that actually, you know, the church establishment sort of hated, because they began to sort of uncover and unearth things that messed up the doctrines a little bit here and there. And so there were societies formed whereby one was supposed to get approval and funding from if one was going off on some sort of expedition into Egypt or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about the way it was done was that the memorandum and articles of what was then called the Egypt Exploration Fund actually set down its rules on the first page there, and it said that fund will provide sponsorship money and will approve expeditions to make discoveries which uphold the scriptural teachings of the Old Testament.
Okay.
Interesting. Which uphold it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What it really meant was, you know, if one went away and discovered something that actually upholds the teachings, and it's not saying upholds the Bible text, it's saying upholds the teachings, which is back to what I first said, that they're different.
Indeed.
But, you know, that would be okay. But if they came back with something which actually didn't uphold it or the teaching or contradicted it in any way, then that was clearly not destined to see the light of day in the public domain as a published discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And this was exactly what happened in 1904 when Britain's foremost archaeologist, a professor at the University College London, a chap called Sir William Flinders Petrie, was funded by the expedition to take a team into Sinai, and while they were there, they looked and found the Mountain of Moses, and there they made probably the most amazing biblical discovery of all time. He came back with great excitement. Everything was suppressed. Artifacts were locked away in vaults, and he was told he would receive no more funding from the society again. And so this poor guy, who was the foremost archaeologist of his day, fell foul of the golden rule, discovered something which actually contravened totally and contradicted totally the teachings of the Old Testament about the story of Moses and the mountain in Sinai, and henceforth he never got any more funding from this country, although he was our leading archaeologist.
Amazing. How many careers have been similarly smashed over the decades?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we can talk about that a little after the break, but interestingly, the BBC got hold of me a few weeks ago, and they said, have you realized that the anniversary of that is next year, 1904 to 2004? And I said, well, yes, I have. And for reasons which I'll explain in a few minutes, they said, it's actually, does it seem to you like an identical story to David Hudson's? Because it's about a very similar discovery, and suddenly it all gets suppressed, and the authorities are sort of bashing you with everything they can get. And I said, well, I hadn't really thought of that. So they've come up with the idea of putting together a documentary on that theme for the anniversary.
Bravo to the Beeb for clear thinking. That's a remarkable foresight.
Mm.
Well done. Good. I'm glad to hear that. All right. Stand by, Lawrence, if you would, and all of you out there. We'll pause and do our business here and come back in just a couple of minutes and continue. A remarkable book. I've said it a couple of times. This is a real page-turner. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Remember that. Lawrence Gardner.
Oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, You can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rents.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rents.com.
Men, let's get a little personal for a minute. I know you hate talking about this stuff, but here goes. Impotence. There, I said it. It was assumed that men lost their sex drive as they got older, but it doesn't have to be that way. Now you can fight loss of libido, decrease in muscle mass, and increased body fat with Recapture Male Vitality. This is a specially formulated supplement that restores your fading supply of testosterone, the hormone that makes a man a man. It's also got plenty of other powerful anti-aging supplements to help you keep the masculine power of your youth. Recapture reverses the effects of testosterone loss, including enhancing your sex drive, increasing your muscle strength, decreasing body fat, and generally making you feel healthier. Recapture Male Vitality is a completely safe, natural liquid that you spray in your mouth every day. Order a 2-month supply of Recapture Male Vitality today, just $54.95. Call toll-free 1-866-764-6733. 1-866-764-6733.
Jeff Rentz continues in 60 seconds.
For one day only, come into Sears and save 50% on select items throughout the store at the Sears Super Saturday Sale. This Saturday, starting at 9 a.m., get 50% off shorts for the family, all kids' swimwear, and all beach towels. Plus, save on the entire lawn and garden department, including mowers and tractors. So hurry into the Sears Super Saturday Sale to get big savings on great brands. Find us online at Sears.com or at America Online, keyword Sears. Sears, good life, great price. Exclusions apply. See store for details. Sale ends 5/17/03.
Roy Masters here. 43 years I've been on the radio helping people overcome their emotional problems. For 2003, I'm releasing my original classic book, How Your Mind Can Keep You Well, with 6 new chapters. It's now available on Amazon.com, Newsmax.com, and my own website, FHU.com. Call Pacific Time, 866-RADIO-ROY. That's 866-RADIO-ROY. Find me again online on FHU.com or on over 100 stations nationwide with my show, Advice Line Overnight. I'm Roy Masters.
Gardner live from the UK, where it's about a little after five in the morning. You're holding forth marvelously.
You're doing well.
Yes, I don't know how you feel, but you sound great.
No, I feel fine.
Getting all these emails from people wanting to invest in Gardnerium, I don't know what to tell them. But...
I'll have to invent that one. I'll discover it next week, maybe.
All right.
Anyway, shall I continue the story Petri, because it's a fascinating story. This fellow took his team out to Sinai, and Sinai, of course, is in the Book of Exodus. It's the landmass that Moses and the Israelites were said to have crossed after they'd left Egypt. They got across to the other side of the Red Sea, and they're crossing this Sinai country to get eventually to the Palestinian land. It's that little triangular bit that sits between the gulfs at the Red Sea, Sinai. It's not massive, but it's pretty, you know, windswept, deserty country. And his job really was out there was to sort of map the area because it had never really been done, and to sort of take account of where the old turquoise mines used to be, that sort of thing. Anyway, while he was there, he decided to get onto the Moses Trail and they followed the route in the Bible, which actually tells you exactly what you have to do to get to this mountain. And it's got nothing to do with the Mount Sinai down the south that the Greek Christian monks invented in the 4th century and still stands there as a tourist attraction today. But they found this mountain. And as always, at the bottom of mountains, what one wants to do is to climb to the top, it seems. So they took the team to the top of this mountain, 2,600 feet. They climbed up this mountain, and lo and behold, on a massive plateau just short of the summit of this mountain, they found the remains of an enormous Egyptian temple. In the middle of nowhere, in the Sinai Desert, an Egyptian temple, not even effectively in Egypt. 230 feet long, this temple, and at the back of it there's a cave, and you move into the cave and there's another great expansive temple within the cave. So this thing is mammoth. And it's dedicated to the goddess Hathor, just the same as at Denderet, her other temple.
Yeah.
It's not in Egypt. Anyway, what struck them as rather odd in the first place was that in terms of what they'd come to recognize a temple to be in sort of latter-day times or modern times, it seemed to have very little to do with it. There it was, looking just like it had looked back in about 1300 BC, which was about when it ceased to be in operation.
That's amazing, yeah.
And even the Bedouin of the area didn't know it was there. They hadn't a clue. They'd never climbed the mountain.
That's just even doubly amazing, yeah.
And so it was there with all the artifacts, and things were just sort of scattered around the place. And they didn't find an altar as such. What they found were strange split level surface tables and benches and things. There was a furnace there, a great furnace. There were all sorts of strange bowls and receptacles and things that looked like magic wands, lots of little conical devices and things like that. And it all seemed to be about making something called mufkets. Mufkets was everywhere in all the inscriptions. There were wonderful reliefs on the walls and standing stones inside the cave. And, I mean, just to give you an example of one of them, we have the treasurer, Shebek Hotep, and he's presenting to one of the 18th dynasty kings the conical loaf. And there are many of these presentations in there, just presenting it. It actually says underneath, you know, here is the treasurer Shebek Hotep presenting the precious stone, so it's back to being a stone, to His Majesty. It's called white bread, and here's the overseer of the House of Gold. Now, this place seems to be called the House of Gold. And if we go back, if we go back to Dendera, we find Hathor called the Mistress of the House of Gold, or the Lady of Gold. She has this gold title. Anyway, it seemed to be about Mufkets. There were lots of references and hieroglyphs relating to light and enlightenment. There were hieroglyphs relating to bread, hieroglyphs relating to gold, and golden Mufkets seemed to be everything that this place was about. And in fact, he said it was more like a chemist lab than it was, you know, a temple. Well, interestingly, I dug a little bit further into that and discovered actually that the word worship, which we associate with temples in the way that they've become, had nothing to do with churches or cathedrals in the way that we understand them. The word, the English word worship, actually had a C or a K in the middle of it, even up to the 5th century, and it was worship. And it was said that those at the temples used to work for the gods. So they didn't venerate the gods and pray for the gods, as worship seems to indicate. They worked for the gods. So this is interesting. This was a place where they worked for Hathor, and seemingly it was all about gold and all about mufkets, and they didn't have a clue what mufkets was, except that it was something to do with these conical cakes that the presentation pictures were showing them.
Was there often discussed a word for it? You pronounce again mufkets, but
yeah, no. I mean, this was looked into in some depth afterwards. You know, once they were back. In fact, not until the 50s.
But nothing then. Okay, all right.
But there, no. It was just described. They knew it had something to do with gold. They knew it was attached to bread. They knew it was attached to conical shapes. And this is exactly what we find at the temple at Karnak. You know, these are the treasures, the greatest treasures of the king at the time. That they're made of gold, and we call them bread. It's all very weird. The bread's to do with the ingestion of the gold powder that's made into these cakes.
I follow you. Yeah.
Anyway, so
We have to pause right there. That's a good place to pause. White bread. What a story! As I told you, this book is one you can't put down. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. We'll be right back to continue our conversation with Lawrence Gardner. This book is available right now at all the usual outlets.
Is the nagging, aching pain in your joints and muscles spoiling your fun in life? Do backaches or arthritis interfere with your daily activities? Then you need Joint Flex. Joint Flex is the only pain reliever that has the exclusive Fusome base with skin conditioning glucosamine, chondroitin, and vitamin E. Joint Flex is an easy-to-apply cream that absorbs quickly, has no greasy residue or lingering medicine-y smell. Best of all, Joint Flex is so effective, we guarantee your nagging pain will reduce or disappear. That's right. If you're not completely amazed with the pain relief you receive from Joint Flex, simply send it back for a full refund. For fast, effective, guaranteed pain relief, call 1-800-211-3062. And now Joint Flex is available at retail stores. Look for the blue box of Joint Flex, the performance guaranteed pain reliever. To find a store near you or to order right now, call 1-800-211-3062. That's 1-800-211-3062.
One quarter, two quarters, it's easy to throw away 50 cents. But what if you could use that 50 cents to buy some peace of mind for your family? You can by calling Matrix Direct Insurance Services. A 35-year-old man can get a quarter of $1 million term life coverage for less than 50 cents a day. A 42-year-old can get a $250,000 coverage for only 60 cents a day. Rates guaranteed 10 years. Call Matrix Direct now for some of the best rates in years from Protective Life Insurance Company, a respected insurer who's protected American families since 1907. The call is free, the quote is free, and you could save 50% or more on quality term life insurance. Call Matrix Direct now. 1-800-440-TERM. That's 1-800-440-TERM. Protective Value Term Policy at select preferred rates subject to underwriting. Term life insurance form TL06. Premiums increase after 10 years. Renewable to age 96. Two-year contestable period. Ron Harris, license agent. Not available in some states.
Do you pay just the minimum on all your credit cards? If you owe $10,000 at $100 a month, that could take you more than 8 years to pay off. And that doesn't include any new charges or interest. Every time you use your credit card, you could be digging yourself in deeper. But there's a nonprofit organization that can help. It's called AmeriDebt. Just call them at 1-800-365-2687. AmeriDebt is a nonprofit credit counseling organization. They can help you significantly reduce your monthly payments and help you pay off your bills faster than you could on your own. AmeriDebt may also be able to eliminate late and over-the-limit fees. AmeriDebt can help you pay off student loans and medical bills, too. With one manageable monthly payment, they can help you get out of debt. That's AmeriDebt. Call 1-800-365-2687 for a free debt consultation. Not available in all states. Call AmeriDebt now. 1-800-365-2687. That's 1-800-365-2687.
Oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, you can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rents.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rents.com.
Patented Trim Spa is an announcer's dream. It's so great talking about a product where the folks who use it say what the radio commercial says. Here's Sheila Gilmore, one of the young lovelies who competed in the Trim Spa American Dream Contest in the Bahamas.
My agent actually recommended Trim Spa. Trim Spa actually did a lot for me. First of all, Trim Spa is a great energy booster. I like taking it first thing in the morning. It gets me going. What I mostly found is that it is an excellent appetite suppressant. I haven't been in this good of shape since I was probably in grade school. I feel healthier. I have more energy. I could go on and on.
Well, maybe you'll settle for the shape that you had at 25. Whatever. Patented Trim Spa burns fat fast. It lets you feel full faster, sparks energy as the pounds melt away, and helps you get your dream body faster than you ever thought possible. Get an amazing 110% guarantee when you order at TrimSpa.com or call 1-800-TRIM-SPA. That's TrimSpa.com or 1-800-TRIM-SPA. Call today. Start losing weight right away.
Amazing information from Lawrence Gardner. Just a hint of what's in the book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Art, published by Element. Okay, I'm just going to let you continue. This story is more than enthralling. So I did make the not flippant remark that there have been more than a few archaeologists' careers destroyed under similar circumstances, not necessarily of the extreme amount of the worth and the importance of this discovery, but similar sorts. You don't want to mess with the machine, or you're out of it. It's real simple.
Well, it's exactly the same, and this was 100 years ago, and it's the same today, isn't it? You know, the establishment sets up its machinery, and, you know, the people that mess with it, they don't have a lot of trouble if they're not trying to be part of it. But, of course, when you're an archaeologist and you're being funded by a part of it, then you become a part of it so that you're subjected to its rules and regulations. It's not like somebody like me who's on the outside of it. They can't expel me from anything because I don't belong to anything. So it's rather different. But if they're part of
it,
then...
I like that idea.
You know, it's good. Anyway, they discovered that this place was all about mufkuts. It was all about gold. It was all about the bread cakes. It was all about feeding them to the kings, and the great treasurers and the overseers were in charge. And they didn't know what it was. They hadn't a clue. Anyway, they were gradually sort of removing the debris and clearing this place. And there are porticos and halls and shrines and all sorts of aspects to this temple. And it's still there. One can visit it today if you want to do the climb. But they went into a storeroom type area, a sort of storage series of rooms there. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, what they discovered there was quite remarkable. That they lifted the stones, and there confronting them was an amazing store, many tons, Petri said, of pure, white, unadulterated powder, just laying there beneath the stones, compressed. He said they had no idea what it was. It was too white to be anything that was obvious. Uh-huh. They thought it might be perhaps the remnants of some sacrifice thing, but then it was pointed out that this was an Egyptian temple. Mm-hmm. The temple dated back to about 2600 BC. It was operative for 1500 years. And every pharaoh from the 4th dynasty to the 8th to the 19th is presented there in some picture or other associated with this stuff.
Still can see it today.
And yeah. Wow. And they tried winnowing it, they tried sieving it, they tried doing everything with it.
Yeah.
And nothing, there was no remnants of any bits of bone or plant life or anything. Uh-huh. It was just tons of pure white powder all stored and secreted there. So they thought, well, this must be the mufkuts, you know, whatever it is. I hadn't a clue what it was, but it was obviously very valuable and seemed to be what everything was about. There were metallurgists, crucibles in this place, furnaces. So Petri comes back to London and he said to them, you know, this is a remarkable place. You know, in the Bible where it says that Moses is at the mountain and the mountain roared and smoked as if there was a furnace on the mountain. He said, well, there was. There was. We found it.
Amazing.
There's a temple there. There's a great big workshop up there. It's massive, and it was all to do with mufkuts and whatever. And he said, you remember the story, and Moses has burned the golden calf. That seems to be what they're doing there. When this stuff was in operation, he said, you've only got to sort of toss a little bit in the air, and it's all over the place. And he said, remember the story about how this white stuff was just seemingly falling from heaven, and the Israelites were picking it up off the ground and eating it, and they called it manna. And you can imagine, they just shrugged their shoulders and sat back and said, wow, this isn't the story. This isn't what we want to hear at all. Within no time at all, in fact, by 1906, 2 years later, it was all over. The teams had been out. They'd collected up just about every available loose artifact that there was. They'd boxed it all up. They'd shipped it all back. They'd brought standing stones. They'd cut wall reliefs out. Some of these are on display, some of the less offensive ones to them are on display in Cairo Museum and Brussels and one or two places, but actually the majority was simply boxed up. And I got hold of the British Museum on this, and I said, do you happen to have anything from there, from that time? And they came back and they said, well, yeah, we do. We have a catalogue list here of 114 items, which we have in storage. And I said, well, what do you mean in storage? They said, well, they're in the crates. We've just had them there since 1906.
Never uncrated.
Never uncrated. So this is actually, again, going back to our BBC documentary, this is what we're trying to rope into it. We're trying to get the filming of the unopening of these crates And so we had this idea of sort of logging in with the final pictures of the Raiders of the Lost Ark film, where they put the Ark in this crate and sort of put it down into a warehouse full of boxes.
There's
and
we're no
kind of reverse that process, you know?
Do we actually think that... No one's gone through these crates to inventory them?
Well, yeah, they know what they are because they were catalogued and inventoried at the time.
Okay.
So we've got a full list of exactly what they are. But it wasn't so much what they were, it was what they represented that was the problem. That was the difficulty. They didn't want to make too much out of this Serabit temple. So when I say that there are artifacts from there in various museums around the world, Cairo and Brussels and other places, they're generally listed as Egyptian. Which is quite interesting, because they are Egyptian. So when people see that they're Egyptian, they imagine that they came from Egypt. They didn't. They came from Sinai.
Extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So what's actually happened is that we're far enough away for the event now, from the event, for everybody to sort of wonder what all the fuss was about, and everybody's being very helpful. So with a bit of luck, we'll have some of these things uncovered. But it's the whole thing tied in. It was a Hathor temple. The Mufkots, as we've seen in modern science, can be made to be superconductive. It will actually become not only anti-gravitational, it will disappear totally into parallel planes of existence.
Gone.
It can be brought back again. It all seems to have to do with Meissner effects and these flux tube portals. And so we come back to the Dendera reliefs, and you know, maybe my nuclear physicist friend was correct. Maybe that's what they're conveying here, that this was another Hathor temple based on a similar theme. The problem was that the above ground part of the temple was destroyed and it was rebuilt during Roman times, so it's got a different context, the above ground part of it. But these things are quite astonishing. But anyway, no sooner had I mentioned this place in the book, I mentioned it first in Genesis of the Grail Kings, actually, and within months I started to get mail from all over the world. People had been out there, they'd climbed the mountain, they were sending me great bunches of photographs of this place, and I've probably got the best photograph collection of places in the world now, and all through readers who'd done the journey, you know.
Fascinating.
But,
amazing. What a story. The chances of the BBC doing this are pretty good, it sounds like.
Well, they're pretty high, except that at the moment the emphasis has been taken off it a little because of the Iraq, the Baghdad Museum thing, you know. The British Museum are now fronting the restoration process there. Well, fortunately, today we've learned that quite a lot of artifacts, over 1,000, I think, now have now been discovered, and they weren't looted at all. They were actually hidden away prior to the invasion. So things are not looking as bad as we thought.
Glad to hear that. It shows some foresight and farsight there, which is a little bit of a relief in this all this nightmare. Stand by, if you would, Lawrence. Our last break and your final segment coming up in just a few minutes. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Lawrence Gardner.
One quarter, two quarters, it's easy to throw away 50 cents. But what if you could use that 50 cents to buy some peace of mind for your family? You can by calling Matrix Direct Insurance Services. A 35-year-old man can get $250,000 term life coverage for less than 50 cents a day. A 42-year-old can get $250,000 coverage for only 60 cents a day. Rates guaranteed 10 years. Call Matrix Direct now for some of the best rates in years from Protective Life Insurance Company, a respected insurer who's protected American families since 1907. The call is free, the quote is free, and you could save 50% or more on quality term life insurance. Call Matrix Direct now. 1-800-440-TERM. That's 1-800-440-TERM. Protective Value Term Policy at select preferred rates, subject to underwriting. Term life insurance form TL06. Premiums increase after 10 years. Renewable to age 96. 2-year contestable period. Ron Harris license agent. Not available in some states.
Staying abreast of what's happening in our world makes sense. But abreast isn't enough. You must learn to see ahead, as well as surmise what's behind the news. Such tools can't be had, like products sold on eBay. What you need lives right inside your own mind. For less than the cost of dinner and a movie, you can expand your perceptive abilities far beyond your imaginations. If you want to really be in the know, order your copy of How Your Mind Can Keep You Well, written by Roy Masters more than 40 years ago. It's already helped tens of thousands find that better life. For only $15.95, you can own one of the world's most powerful personal awareness tools. Call 800-877-3227 and ask our operators about the companion CD that can bring wondrous changes to you, your family, and our nations. Friends, this is way beyond political. Call now and learn exactly how your own mind can keep you well. That's 800-877-3227.
Jeff Rentz continues in 60 seconds.
For one day only, come into Sears and save 50% on select items throughout the store at the Sears Super Saturday Sale. This Saturday, starting at 9 a.m., get 50% off shorts for the family, all kids' swimwear, and all beach towels. Plus, save on the entire lawn and garden department, including mowers and tractors. So hurry into the Sears Super Saturday Sale to get big savings on great brands. Find us online at Sears.com or at America Online, keyword Sears. Sears, good life, great price. Exclusions apply. See store for details. Sale ends 5/17/03.
Can't figure out why you're not sleeping well? Maybe the trouble is in your bed. Conventional mattresses create pressure points that make you toss and turn. But now there's a bed guaranteed to give you a better night's sleep. It's the Tempur-Pedic Swedish mattress. The Tempur-Pedic mattress reduces the pressure points that make you toss and turn. So get a great night's sleep guaranteed. Call Tempur-Pedic now for a free video and sample at 1-800-372-2552. That's 1-800-372-2552.
Segment, and what a quick 2 hours with Lawrence Gardner. Remember, you can hear this program in the archives anytime at all, courtesy of Soundwaves 2000. The Ark itself, Lawrence, certainly key to much of our history and our folklore. It's woven into so many stories and fables and everything else. Did it actually exist in a physical form? What's the upside of that? And if not, is it a conceptualized object which has taken up residence in our distant memory?
Well, the concept of arcs is, in terms of there being boxes, coffers, whatever, is I suppose Egyptian, in as much as that the Ark of the Covenant described in the Bible really fits the Egyptian model pretty precisely, and there are lots of examples of those sort of arcs. Tutankhamun's famous ark with Anubis on top, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are many others with sort of angelic goddess creatures with outstretched wings and that sort of thing, just like the Bible explains. The Bible tells us, and this is again sort of fascinating, because the story of the ark begins at this mountain in Sinai. It's really all part of the same story. Moses has done the golden calf thing, and then they're told to build the Ark of the Covenant, and this Ark is described. What struck me as a little bit odd about it was that just after the Ark incident, God has apparently said to Moses, henceforth there shall be no graven images, you shall not make life representations of any living creature in heaven or on earth or under the sea, and then immediately says, and go and build this Ark and put two golden cherubs on the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense again.
A little bit of a problem.
It rather seems to me as if it got in a little bit strangely, because probably the Ark was already there and wasn't made at the time. The descriptions of the Ark are given precisely in the Bible, all its dimensions, how it was made, what it was made of. It's gold-plated, double-plated inside and out. It has a solid gold lid. Interestingly, I spoke to the World Gold Council about it, and they calculated that on those specifications, it weighed about a ton and a half.
Hmm.
Overall. And the lid alone, just the lid of solid gold, the thickness that it was, would be worth about $10.5 million today.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an astonishing artifact, an astonishing box. And Actually, legend has it that it contained the Ten Commandments, which in fact the Old Testament doesn't tell us that it contained at all. It doesn't say that the Ten Commandments were put into the Ark. It says that the testimony was put into the Ark, which was a different thing altogether.
I see. 3,000 pounds. So four guys in poles aren't going to be carrying
this. Well, that's right. They're not going to. But on the other hand, there's all sorts of stories within the Bible and certainly in Jewish philosophical works like the Midrash, the Talmud, this sort of thing that talk about the Ark of the Covenant levitating, and I mean it went before them in battle in the Bible, apparently a thousand mm-hmm. paces before the men. It seemed to travel on its own. It was responsible mm-hmm. to help them bring down the walls of Jericho. It seemed to be awesome in its destructive powers. Lightning bolts emanated from it and it killed people. Anyway, again, we sort of, you know, built this thing on computer and worked out, and it seemed that actually, if you follow the specifications, what you've actually built is a very, very powerful electronic condenser. Now, the word ARC, spelled in Greek with a K, but actually spelled with a C outside, just like ARC is today,
mm-hmm.
Is exactly the word that electronic arcing comes from, and it means, the word ARC meant a gathering box. A box that gathered something. So it wasn't just for putting things in, it wasn't for storing, it was for gathering. And in fact, it rather seems that this device, if you've got your two cherubs or whatever they are on top, and you've connected one to the negative plate and one to the positive plate on the outside platings of the box, it will just pull in energy from the atmosphere and will give forth about 50,000 volts in no time. It's very, very powerful. Now, within this, it seems that what was put was not the Ten Commandments, but the white powder, the substance. And in fact, at a later stage in the Bible, it actually tells us that an omer of manna was placed in the ark, and so the manna is the white powder, it's the same thing. Now, once one actually does that, once one gets this superconductive material and has it in a highly electronically charged state, I mean, it can actually reach the danger point where it will dish out gamma rays. It can be that dangerous.
Yeah.
But it will also do very powerful electronic arcing. It will do all of these things. And, this idea of it being an electronic condenser was put forward quite some time ago by, I think even Discovery Channel or something had it on about 5 or 6 years back, I remember. But it was sort of ignored because it was said they didn't have electricity in those times. Well, actually, you don't have to have electricity. It's there all the time. It's around us, you know. It's in the atmosphere. You just have to collect it.
Nikola Tesla, sure.
So they clearly knew how to collect it. Interestingly, in the year 2000, the British Museum put out a book, a fascinating, very heavy volume, and they and a team from America, I believe it was from Harvard University, I think, it was a conjoined team, went out of Western Turkey to Lydia to look at the gold mines of King Croesus, who was apparently the first king ever in about 800 BC to make gold coinage.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the most astonishing discovery, and in the end, they said in their preface to the book that we've had to write this book ourselves. We couldn't pass it to an author because its contents wouldn't believe the author, but they have to believe us because we're the British Museum.
Uh-huh.
And what they found there were electroplating works. Quite astonishing, not just a refinery for gold, but their ability to do electrolysis, to remove impurities from gold, to do electroplating. Subsequent to that, tests were made back on the artifacts from Ur in ancient Sumer that were in the Baghdad Museum and other places.
Mm-hmm.
What they thought were solid gold artifacts from 3000 BC, swords and daggers and things like that. They always thought they were solid gold. These turn out not to be gold at all now. They turn out to be a heavy alloy with the same density of gold, but gold-plated.
Oh,
so even in 3000 BC, they're doing this plating and they have electricity. Not surprising because it's a natural thing. They clearly knew how to harness it and how to use it.
The arcing device
and it becomes the storage device. And it on that basis, it becomes thoroughly and totally superconductive. It will levitate. It will do all the things mm-hmm. that science is discovering for this stuff today.
The obvious question is, where did that original knowledge come from? Them or
predecessors?
Well,
that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there are things that can be discovered by accident. You know, discovering fire. Against that stone and it makes fire or whatever.
Sure.
I'm not quite sure how one discovers things like this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's...
How do you discover alchemy and all the rest of it?
That's right. And then why would you eat it, you know, if you knew it was made of gold? We're actually led into a situation here where really, I suppose, we can only hypothesize, but it really does appear, even just going back into the Mesopotamian texts now, mm-hmm. which are older than the Egyptian ones even, and they talk about the substance. We know there that they were using it certainly in 3000 BC, and that's all we know, but who knows when before that? You know, the writings didn't start until that sort of third millennium.
Another
the
quick
information
question.
Came from somewhere, so yes. You know we're back really to the debate about who are we, where did we come from, who were the gods? Who
exactly.
I mean, the gods were the people that were doing the training here. The temples were dedicated to the gods always.
Mm-hmm. Look
so
at that
we're
picture.
We're in the realm of the Anunnaki gods.
That's right.
According to the old text, came down from somewhere. Well, we don't really know whether that was out of space or from the top of some mountain, but there actually aren't any mountains in that part of Iraq. There are in the north, you know, the Taurus Mountains at the top, but it really leads us to suspect that there is perhaps some form of extraterrestrial involvement here, and you know, this coming from me 10 years ago would have been thought very strange by many people. I was a very straightforward historian at one time. I still am, but I'm managing to ground things that seem out of order in my past context. Now, the interesting thing here is that we know that platinum group metals, like iridium, for example, that the metal iridium is an extraterrestrial metal. We mine it here in deep seams in certain places, but it doesn't come from this earth. It's not native to us. It comes from out there somewhere, and it's only been brought in the past by asteroids, meteorites. Now, sometimes it will embed it into deep underground seams. Other times, that the burning impact, if it hits a too hard surface when it hits, it will actually explode into a great blaze of light. And that's when the iridium in the asteroid or whatever will turn into this monatomic state. It's exactly how we can do it today. So that's how they find the natural substances. And Arizona, of course, has got a massive asteroid crater there, so maybe that explains David Hudson's. But this is the bit of the question that puzzles me and might just be a good thing to ponder upon.
Indeed.
We know that iridium is an extraterrestrial metal. We know that this applies to other platinum group metals like rhodium, whatever. They're not native to here. They're very, very scarce. And yet, up until a few years ago, we were told that 5% by dry weight of our brain tissue was composed of carbon. Well, it's now known that is iridium and rhodium in this monatomic high-spin state. So how do we get it in us if it's extraterrestrial?
Amazing. Well, the person who painted that Renaissance Baptism of Jesus painting perhaps knew more. I'd like to talk to you again. Probably 800 other radio hosts would as well, Lawrence. I want to thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Jeff.
Being up at the middle of the night. Thank you, sir. We'll talk.
It's been so good. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Gardner, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. And where did that knowledge go? How did it fall into a seemingly bottomless pit 1,500, 2,000 years ago? This is an extraordinary story laid out magnificently in his book, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark. Thanks for choosing to spend your time here tonight. I'll be back tomorrow in 21 hours. Have a great day and take good care.